You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here to my right, I've got Martin Page.
How you doing, Mike?
Next to him, I've got Scott Gershon.
Hi, Mike.
Next to him, I've got Bobby Summerfield.
Hello, geezer.
Next to him, we've got Andrew Sheps.
Hi, Mike.
And next to him, we've got Rob Arbitier.
Hello, Mike.
Oh, yeah.
Welcome back, Rob.
Thank you. It's good to be back. Was I here last
You
time?
Were here.
Physically?
You were here. Physically, you were here, actually.
Cool.
Mentally, not.
I want to go back and listen to that one.
Hey, guys, this is the third show in a row.
Good gracious.
That everybody's been here.
Mm.
So that means one of two things. You either have a really good time doing this, or nobody has work right now.
I'm only here because Rob's car broke down. Otherwise,
I did need a ride.
Hey, let me introduce our guest for tonight. Tonight, our guest is Rich Ezra. And Rich runs the Music Business Directory. And why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do, Rich?
Okay. We publish essentially five different contact directories for the music business. We do a record company directory. We do a music publishing directory. We do a music attorney directory. We do a record producers and recording engineer directory. And we do a film and television music guide. And they're essentially like our record company directory. We update and reprint every 8 weeks. Our publisher directory we do twice a year, and the rest of them we do once a year.
Wow, so it's like a 411 basically for the industry.
Exactly, except the 411s are done once a year, and right. We do ours every 8 weeks. So it's sort of it's the only book of its kind that's completely updated and reprinted and sent out to you every 8 weeks as a subscriber.
Well, we're going to find out a little bit more about Rich a little bit later on in the podcast because amongst other things, he used to be an A&R guy for Clive Davis over at Arista Records.
So, who's that? I never heard of him.
And that's why you're at the podcast. Hey, but before we get into that, NAMM Show.
Actually, it was the best NAMM show for me this year.
Really? Was it the best one you've ever?
Bobby didn't go.
You missed it like a hole in the head.
Well, first of all, I want to tell you that I did not see the guy playing the little tube this year.
Really?
I have to say I was a little disappointed. But I did see
his wife finally made him get a job. That's what that means.
Yeah, he's running for president.
That's right. Ooh. The development money ran out. But I did see the guy with the plastic
don't go there.
This was right after the show.
Oh man, talk about just my mind just goes blank.
Hold on, the guy with the plastic.
What
happens in NAMM stays in NAMM.
Okay, that's a big edit. What's the Australian instrument you blow through it?
Didgeridoo. Oh, I saw that guy too.
Yeah, he had a plastic didgeridoo.
Mm-hmm.
And also had okay. One. He also had.
Still sounds bad.
He also had one arm too.
Yeah, he did.
It was a one arm plastic.
From playing with his didgeridoo too much.
Wow, this went bad really quick. So, Rob, at the NAMM show.
Oh yeah, that's a way to bring it back. Turn to me.
Hey, Rob, at the NAMM show, what did you see? Did you see anything that was kind of groundbreaking? What was your favorite thing you saw at the NAMM show? If you saw anything that was your favorite.
Actually, the funny part is the NAMM show has basically become a huge group of people all turning to each other and saying, "Did you see anything cool?" You know, everybody's asking everybody else what they saw. There are not usually too many things that'll build a buzz across the whole show, but I'd have to say there was only one thing this year that I thought was really revolutionary. I mean, there were a lot of upgrades and a lot of new versions of things, but Korg introduced a little portable recorder that records in DSD format at 2.8 and 5.6 megahertz, which is incredibly good quality audio. And it's a little tiny handheld recorder for location recording or whatever. The big one runs on 8 AA batteries, and the small one is the size of an iPod, basically. And it can record DSD, and it just sounds incredible. And the street price for the big one is like $1,200. So for a stereo portable recorder, I don't know of anything else, definitely in that price range, but anything else, period, that's going to match that quality. We haven't done a lot of listening tests yet. We've already started checking this thing out.
You guys see how the mic pre-sound.
We have to see how the mic pre-sound. We have to hear how the analog front end sounds for being that cheap. But
and then also, I
it's
think
incredible. Though.
I'm also curious to see the mic pre's and then the conversion. So when it goes into, let's say, 9624, you know, what's the quality?
Well,
of the
you know
conversion?
What? The thing that's cool about it is it comes with a utility. So when you hook this thing up to your computer, you can then stream either DSD through your computer, or it can downsample it to anything. To 192 is a downsample from DSD. So you can downsample to 192, 96, 48, 44, 1, whatever, and it does it in real time. And I have to say the listening tests I did, they have some recordings of acoustic guitar that were done straight into the box, and they sound incredible.
You said the conversion is done in real time?
Yeah.
Ow.
I believe so.
So if you record 4 hours of audio, it's 4 hours of transfer?
I don't know about that. I mean, for us, that was a cool feature because it's nice to be able to listen in real time through different sample rates. I don't know if they have a batch thing that's faster that does it, you know, not in real time. For us, I was looking at this for Stevie because for him, a recorder like this is sort of like having a digital camera for us because right. You can go out in the world and record sounds incredibly cleanly now. And so for our purposes, we need to be able to play that stuff in real time to listen back to it. You know, they probably do have some kind
they
of batch conversion because when you hook this thing up to your computer, it just looks like a hard drive.
Right.
And you can then drag the files off. I don't know. I don't know about that.
Because also when I go record, I record hours and hours. And
yeah. I don't know if they have that batch stuff. And you know, it's not a multi-channel recorder yet. It's just stereo.
Right.
But for something new that I didn't expect to see a two-channel DSD recorder that fits in the palm of your hand for $1,200. That was pretty cool.
That's pretty cool. Hey, Andrew, did you see anything at NAMM Show that you thought was the coolest, next best thing?
Well, besides me?
Well, Rob.
Yeah.
Not really. I was only down there for one day, and I didn't see anything stellar in terms of gear. But there was, I think, my favorite moment. I saw probably 10 minutes into the show, because it came in down at registration in the 1000 hall, where the guy with the plastic didgeridoo and all the stranger booths are usually down there. And Analog Haven had a booth, and they're a store out in Pomona that sells right. modular synths. And I've been out there a couple of times, so I kind of went over to the booth to see what they had. And they had, you know, basically all the modular synths there. But the best part of it was that the entire booth, you can hear it from, I don't know, 20 or 30 feet away, and it's all analog drum machines going through resonant filters with things beeping and squealing and making all these horrible noises. And right next to the booth was someone who works at the convention center with one of those, like, slushy machines. And she's selling, you know, freeze pops or something. And the look on her face, and this was, you know, I don't know, an hour in on the second day, and she looked like she wanted to kill herself.
That was excellent.
Yeah.
That's pretty
That's
bad.
A really bad place to be. Well, no, and there was one other thing, actually. Alan Sides of Oceanway was showing a speaker system. He's been designing monitors for studios for 30 years or something, but he had a sort of a prepackaged four-way system that he was showing, and he could only play it for about 20 seconds because then he got shut down because it was way too loud. But it sounded good.
You know what else I forgot to mention because Andrew and I both saw this, but they showed a new sampler software for Pro Tools.
Oh, yeah.
Structure, which
seems like that's going to be pretty cool because you can fluidly go between disc recording and keyboard sampling and back and forth.
And you can just drag and drop stuff.
And they're
going
to have an open beta for it. So everyone I knew went to the website, signed up for it, and the beta site and the website doesn't work.
Excellent.
Ouch.
That sounds like Vista.
Then you got Vista.
Hey, Scott, did you see anything that was kind of cool? Or
well, other than the fashion show, I thought it was very fashion-y this year compared to other years where it's gotten really boring. And I saw, like, the bikers and the punkers and a lot of makeup. It's like everyone just came off of stage, came straight to the NAMM show and looking for gear. Mm-hmm. But, no, I saw a couple of little things. I don't remember the name. There's a mastering device plugin from some German guys, and it was pretty cool. It's a double it's an MS system where what it does is, I feel like I'm off mic, is it takes the sounds that are similar between both speakers, puts it down the mono, and gives you a separate stereo spread. This way you can then EQ them totally separate and recombine it.
Hmm.
So you can take your mixes and make them punchier, you can make them wider, and it was pretty impressive. It's something that I think Digi is going to start carrying, is what I was told. Structure was pretty cool. Duendo by SSL is fascinating. It's basically a DSP engine that allows you to do 32 channels of SSL EQ and compression.
Hmm. Digital SSL EQ compression.
Yeah, it works on anything. It works on Digi, works on Duendo, works on...
Interesting.
So I thought, wow, if it... The question is how good did they get the modeling and it's great because you don't have to use a Digi card. They've also got I.O. that works in Digi Design that's cheaper, and instead of doing 16 channels, gives you 24 channels of A to Ds. Also something that wasn't there, but I wanted to say at the last podcast, Rob and I had a friend that just turned me on. I just bought a new mic called, it's a Sanken mic. And it's a 5-channel mic. It's a double MS mic, which is actually really cool. It's looks like a shotgun mic. Looks very similar to the CSS5 and records in 5 channels.
Holy smokes.
And it's got the reach of a shotgun, so it's amazing. I had my son run around and actually stood in the middle of Hollywood Boulevard, have cars all the way around me, and recorded that, and it's been very impressive.
And how many tracks does it record to?
And it's like $3,500. So it's for 5 channels.
Wow. And so you have to go to a 5-channel recorder then. So
yeah. What I've got right now, I'm working with a 744, or I use a Diva as a mobile recorder. But it was impressive. The surrounds have a little bit of boost at 8K, so it's got a little sizzle. I found just take a little bit of EQ and roll it off, because you'd be rolling off anyway, the high end on the surrounds, just a little bit.
Wow.
Just so it's not, you know, distracting. But I was very impressed with the mic, enough that I bought it. So,
well, that's cool.
That's one of my new purchases.
Well, let's see, at the NAMM show, I saw the M3. Did you guys see that?
The Korg.
Oh, yeah, the Korg. Which one?
The M3 from Korg. It's their new sampling workstation. And the cool thing that I liked about that was that it came in module form, much like their Radius.
Mm-hmm.
But you can put it into different size keyboards. So if you want to put it into a 61 note, then you can put it into 61 note or 72 or 88. And I thought that was kind of cool. And, you know, it had all the, you know, the typical sampling workstation, you know, magic and all mm-hmm. the Korg sounds. But I thought that was really cool. The other thing that I found was the bass drum pedal that had no springs. It used magnets to give it the bounce.
Wow.
It had two strong magnets, reverse polarity. And when you, just like a regular bass drum, when you hit it and the magnets squeeze together and then they push it apart and there was no springs.
And had a nice little response to it?
It was, you know what, it wasn't that bad, to be honest. It felt a little weird because, you know, with a spring you've got that curve of the tension mm-hmm. and you don't on the magnets, but it was surprisingly usable and
you all just can't keep your credit cards in your shoes because of the rest of them. That's the only downside.
Or don't drop your iPod.
Yeah, that's true, too. One other bit of news from NAMM. When we had Marvin here from Aphex last show, we were using one of his little headphone boxes, and he was saying that he's not sure yet if it's going to be a product.
Is it going to be?
And I don't know for sure if it's going to be, but I went by his booth a few times just to say hi, and he was getting huge response for the thing.
Oh, that's great.
So he got... It sounded great last week or 2 weeks ago,
yeah. Wow.
But he got a huge response, so that may become a product.
Well, that's great. That's good for Marvin because he's a nice guy.
He is a nice guy.
And that's a great little headphone amp. And mm-hmm. so as soon as we get some information, we'll be telling everybody about the headphone amp.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, you guys, I wasn't really inspired by anything else at NAMM this year. Nothing really – it seemed like everybody was looking for something, like you said, Rob, but nothing really took off, which I think is kind of cool because
– Well, it means people are working on – new things. Well, it doesn't necessarily mean it, but what I found is that in this case, there are a lot of companies that are working on new technologies that aren't quite ready yet. I mean, it was interesting that Spectrasonics wasn't even there.
Right.
and they sent out a mass mailing saying they weren't going to be there because right. they're working on new stuff and there really wasn't anything to show.
Right.
But there were also a lot of products I saw, like there's a plugin called or a program called Sinful, S-Y-N.
Right, I saw that.
F-U-L, which is, you know, doing some neat things with orchestral sounds. And there were a few other companies like that. You know, Arturia showed a hardware synth that can
nice.
Play. It can play their virtual plugin, so you can play their CS80 and their Jupiter 8 and their Moog modular and all these things. But if you play them in their hardware instead of on your computer, you can patch like the filter from the Moog to the oscillator from
the
ARP or whatever,
yeah.
or the Prophet. So it's a cool piece of hardware, but they're saying it'll be ready in September.
And it shows
there
up.
There are a lot of things like that.
And it shows up on your computer.
Oh, that's
it shows
cool.
up as a plugin.
As
kind
a
of the
plugin.
Way the, like the Virus TI does yeah. now, which is pretty cool. And it finally works.
Yeah, and it's like three TI. Shark cards. I saw that as well. Very impressive.
Mm-hmm.
I just think one of the good things about not always, you know, having these big giant paradigm shifts at every NAMM show is it just allows you to use the gear that you got and not feel like you have to go out there and buy your way to the next level or anything. And you yeah. can just concentrate on some of the plugins you already have.
You mean with MacTel and Vista?
I will say this. A friend of mine named Mike Lambie, who has a company called SoundQuest, and for a long time he's been developing a SysX MIDI editor called MIDIQuest. I ran into him at the show, and I've been using his SysX librarian editor for many years. And he showed me he had a MacTel laptop, and he had a Mac program on one side of the screen and Windows running in a window, running the Windows copy of that program on the other half of the screen. So in real time, he was running the Mac and Windows version side by side, and they're both active, and they're both accessing the hardware. I mean, it was pretty impressive.
It's pretty amazing. Like, in the last podcast, I was telling everybody that I got the MacBook Pro, the 17-inch, and let me tell you, it really is amazing that one machine can run both Windows and can run Mac OS.
And now, simultaneously, you don't have to switch between them.
Yeah, but there's certain things.
But will it run Vista?
Yeah, actually,
they say
it will. Actually, will, yeah. Right. And the thing about, see, I don't run Parallels where you can run an OS inside an OS because when I need to run my Windows side, it needs to be a Windows machine. It needs to access everything like a Windows machine, and I don't want any interrupts with the COM ports or anything like that.
So have you tried to run like Pro Tools with SoundForge?
Well, no, not at the same time, because I can run Pro Tools on the Windows or PC side, and then I can run SoundForge. That's one of the programs that I have because I love SoundForge, so I use that on the Windows side of things. But here's the cool thing. If you get the 7.3 update for Pro Tools LE, it puts in the system, it allows you to read Mac drives. So you can actually copy stuff over when you're in Windows onto your Mac drive and pull things off your Mac drives because you've partitioned your drive into like a Windows partition and a Mac partition. So as an added bonus, 7.3 now will read Mac drives. Well, it turns your whole machine, gives you the whole machine the ability to read Mac drives. So it's pretty cool. It's really useful. But anyhow, that's enough about the NAMM because I'm sure we've probably lost
some. I just wanted to say one other thing about NAMM, which had nothing to do with seeing products. But the thing that I noticed, and we actually talked about it with a few other people, is that the record industry might be in a whole lot of trouble, but the music industry is in no trouble at all.
Sure, yeah.
That show was packed with people making music at home.
That's true.
Absolutely packed.
That's true, and that, you know, it's.
I think
really
AES is getting smaller, but NAMM keeps getting bigger.
You would
bigger
never know
year.
That there's a music issue at hand. It was packed.
Yeah, and it's all people who have seen American Idol or whatever and want to do music at home, and they can get it for not much money, and they get in there and they just do it.
You know, one thing I also wanted to say that I thought was an interesting, different approach. Waves came out with a product called Max Volume. And what's interesting is with flat screen TVs and a lot of, you know, audio in some ways in television reproduction is really getting crappier because they're trying to accommodate, you know, flat screens and smaller monitors. So they come out with a kind of a combination of all their plugins, and they create something called Max Volume, which gives you more bass. It's kind of an enhancer and it makes everything sound way better. And also, for, you know, when you're at home late and the wife's going, can you turn it down? They've also got a dynamic controller that allows you different...
To control your wife.
Right? Yeah, control your wife.
I'll buy one of those.
Max wife. Yeah. But, no, I thought that was kind of interesting how they're also trying to solve that issue.
What do you put through it, though? Do you put your own mixes through it? Or do you
you could basically put mixes through it. So when you're doing television mixes, right. Because you're dealing with a lot of the dynamics that you have to do with broadcast, it will not only limit your broadcast, which you're going to be doing anyway, but also does certain enhancements which will make your mixes sound even better.
Wow.
So it's got a combination of like Ren bass and volumes, and it's a whole bunch of their technologies wrapped up, and it's like pretty impressive.
Like an Uber plugin.
Yeah.
Wow. Hey, Rich, have you ever been to a NAMM show?
I have, yes. I find it exhausting when I go to NAMM. I can make it usually one day and, you know, 3-4 hours tops, and it's overwhelm. It's just overwhelm. I didn't go this year, but I've been like the last two or three.
Now, in music in general, have you noticed any trends that, that for you, from your perspective, being from an A&R, point of view, that have either helped or hurt music industry, you know, like loops or some of the sampling or?
Well, I think, you know, one of the most, I think, profound changes that has, it's helped and hindered in that is the fact that I think an artist today, a musical artist today starting out has to have, has to be more accountable for their career than at any other point that I can remember. And I've been in this business for 27 years, and I've never seen the culture in the music industry be where all of that support system is gone. It's essentially where an artist has to come up to such a level of visibility before the industry even recognizes them. They have to be able to sell records. They have to be able to sell concert tickets. And I think what's interesting about this is that, you know, because nobody wants to sign an act today that's just basically, you know, what I call the faith-based signing, where, my God, this is such a talented act, we have to get involved. They want a story.
Right.
They want somebody who has sold records, even if it's on a small scale, somebody who has toured. And I think that, you know, this gets into the whole thing of artist development, which is, you know, a whole other issue, is that the record industry has, they do not... How do I put this? They no longer want to be in the business that they've helped create for the last 40 years.
Right.
They now want to be in the marketing and promotion business.
Well, before we even move on, let's back up.
Okay.
Rich runs the music business directory, but you were also an A&R person for Clive Davis. A lot of people don't know what an A&R person does. Why don't you tell us a little bit about when you were doing A&R in the quote unquote old days of, you know, records, what that was all about?
An A&R job, it serves two primary functions. An A&R person's job is, number one, to find and discover and bring in new talent. That's the first job of an A&R person. The second part of an A&R person's job is something that's never spoken of, which I find really interesting, which is to build and maintain the careers of the artists already on the label. And that never gets talked about. You know, Right. Everybody thinks it's all about running out to clubs and that's part of it. But then what happens when you find your artist? You have to make the record. You have to get the producers. You have to get the songwriters. You have, you know, I know Martin's been in that process both as a writer and a producer and an artist. I mean, there's a lot of process in making a record, depending on what kind of an artist you're working with. If you're working with a self-contained act, it's going through all that material. So those are the two primary functions of an A&R person. An A&R person, too, is like a salesperson within a record company. It's the first point of contact that an artist has at the label, and it then becomes that person's job in A&R to sort of, if you will, sell the artist to the rest of the company, to get promotion excited, to get marketing and sales and publicity excited about the act, to let them know what this act is about, to sort of educate them. And that's a fine balance. You know, you don't want everybody coming down to the studio all at once, but you want to be able to introduce that artist to promotion. You want to be able to introduce them to, you know, publicity. You want to be able to get everyone on your side so that when it comes time to market that record, that the setup is there.
Right.
So you're sort of an internal salesperson, too. Those are the sort of the best way I can describe the role of A&R.
So you really have a tremendous amount of power, I guess, to help mold these careers and help push them in different directions.
In a sense, I don't see it as power as much as, you know, you work with artists that you find, and I think different A&R people have different skills. I think, You know, you look at somebody like a great A&R guy was somebody named John Kolodner, who worked at Geffen for a long time, and I know Martin's worked with him before. And what made Kolodner such a great A&R guy was not only that he had, you know, tremendous sense with artists. You know, he brought Aerosmith back. He signed a lot of very successful acts. He also had the ability, not only in rock, but in pop music, he had the ability to match songs with the artists. Mm. He brought She Revived Cher's career. And that's a separate gift. That's a real severable talent. It's one thing, I think, to be able to go into a club and to see a Guns N' Roses or a Peter Gabriel and say, that is a great artist. It's quite another thing to be able to, now that you know that it's a great artist, to make a great record with them. They're two separate talents.
See, I think that's the reason why I use the word power in there is because sometimes, you know, artists, their careers get to a point where you need a little push. And
right.
It seems to me if your A&R person has that power, has that mojo to push you on, to get you past that little rough point, whether it's finding writers or matching you up with the songs like you're talking about.
Yeah, it all depends on the relationship that an A&R person has with an artist. There's a lot of artists that are very open to that. There's a lot of artists that it takes a lot of convincing. I know, you know, we can go back to John Kolodner. When he got Aerosmith on Geffen, they were at the very bottom of their career. They had been through rehab twice. There were a lot of problems. He got them to be convinced that they should be writing with other people, that their own material that they were coming up with wasn't quite as strong to relaunch their career. That's an easier thing said than done.
Well, yeah.
Because when you have a band like Aerosmith who has a long history of writing their own material and putting records out, a lot of times artists like that don't want to hear it. And so it takes somebody who they really trust and respect to say, you know, you really should be working with this guy named Desmond Child. You know, you really should be working with a Martin Page or whoever. And that, Martin can speak to this too, because that's a very difficult thing when you're working with an artist who has always written on their own, to suddenly say, you know, these songs aren't working and maybe you should consider collaborating.
Right.
Even though you know that, you know, the results can be astonishing, you know, and very successful. I know, you know, Martin with These Dreams or We Built the City. I mean, those two songs helped revive the two artists involved. Both were number one hits and helped revive their careers and took them to levels that they would have not been had they just written material on their own.
Right.
So
I even found in that era, though, when I was working with Rich, that you'd find the artists were always a little dubious about.
Sure, they were.
Writing, and it took an A&R man they trusted.
Yes.
To actually walk them through the door like
Don Grierson was another example of an A&R guy who had that skill, that thing you're talking about.
Gary Gersh was like
Gary Gersh, exactly. Yeah. Another one at Geffen.
Who were some of the acts that you worked with that you...
Let's see. The Grateful Dead, Dionne Warwick, the Thompson Twins, which was an act that I was involved with at Arista. Tanya Tucker, who else? Who were some of the others that we had?
That was quite a special era, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we had a lot of people. You know, we had we did a deal with Jive Records, which was a very successful independent label.
Right.
That's how I met Martin.
So you were there with the Flock of Seagulls?
Flock of Seagulls we had, yeah. In 1980, 81, 82, yeah.
Okay, wait, was it the A&R guy that told them about the hair, or no?
No. We took them as we got them. That was just the way they came.
Wow.
I have to step in here as well, because Rich is very much a song-oriented A&R man, and sometimes in my travels when I was doing a lot of that, seeing all the record companies, it was rare to find A&R men that were really into the songwriting and would understand songs. And Rich has always been that way, which I think has to be mentioned, because a lot of the success that came through that era was understanding songs, wasn't it, Rich?
Yes, very, very
and
much so.
And getting close to songwriters. You
very
know?
Much so. Yeah. And, you know, the examples that we talked about, whether, you know, it was Aerosmith or Heart or Starship or any number of acts that benefit Bon Jovi, any number of acts that benefited from, you know, working outside of the confines of their own band,
right,
had huge successes. And it was a very, very important aspect. And I think it's an important point that Martin's bringing up, because it's very distinct today where you don't see that hardly at all. You don't see it in rock music anyway. You see it more in the pop and the R&B field with entertainers who don't write necessarily the material they need outside songs. But you certainly don't see it with rock bands, that willingness to co-write, that willingness to, you know, maybe they don't feel they need to do it. Maybe it's the A&R people who don't have a sense of material. It takes somebody who has that understanding and can say, you know, you would really be good with working with Martin Page, or, you know, I know, like, you've worked with Robbie Robertson. You've worked with a lot of very successful people who have been known to be solo artists and write on their own. And it's difficult. It's difficult with a lot of artists today who feel, you know, this is something that I do, and sort of take it or leave it. And
why do you think that's changed? Sorry, why do you think that's different now?
It's interesting. I think it's because there's not the kind of push with rock bands to have success on pop radio, and I think part of that is that alternative radio, the KROQs of the world, etc., have broken a lot of acts on their own and don't necessarily need that kind of crossover push to pop or AC. You know,
well, do you think it's because the bands are more disposable?
I'm sorry?
Do you think because now the bands are more disposable?
I think that that has a lot to do with it. I think that sort of gets into a whole other thing. I think that music has become much more disposable to today's generation. I don't think that they have the kind of an, I mean, I'm 47, and I, you know, when I grew up, you had that kind of an investment in an artist, in an album, and I don't think artists, today have that kind of impact in culture with youth. I think youth is very much, that whole concept of listening to a whole album is foreign to them. I think they will listen to individual songs, or they'll have their iPod that has 5 or 10,000 songs, but the concept of a whole album, it's not, I mean, there's a couple issues with that. Number one, I think it's a creative problem that they've sort of grown up in an era when there were no artists really giving them whole albums, with very rare exception, that they really could get into. And I also think, you know, the whole iTunes generation has sort of devalued, if you will, that that whole experience of buying an album and really spending time to listen to a body of work, if you will, 10 songs, or, you know, God forbid, a double album, you know, like The Wall or Tommy or something like that, you
double
know?
Album.
And yet I know, who is it that worked with the Chili Peppers? You know, and yeah, the Chili Peppers, and you know, and you did a great job on that new record, and that's one of the very few double yes. albums that's come out by a major yeah, act in recent times, you know, and I don't know what spurred that on, if it was just a huge creative outburst that they had of material.
Yeah, I mean, they had 38 songs and were trying to put out all 38 and realized, well, the best way to do it was just to do a double album with 28, right. Get it out there. But yeah, I mean, they just happened to have the songs to do it.
Yeah, it's not something that's common, as you know. I mean, today it's hard enough to get a record with just 10 great or 14 mm-hmm. great ones with
two great songs to be good.
two great,
even one.
And I think that speaks to the issue that you were asking about.
Hey, we're going to take a break right now, but when we come back, we'll pick this up as to why new bands won't write with songwriters.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Aphex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the L.A. area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were talking with Rich Ezra, who publishes the Music Business Directory, about new bands and why they're reluctant to write with songwriters. And I think one of the reasons why new bands, new acts are reluctant to write is because the publishing has become so important in today's music economy. When you figure the sales of the hardware, as Martin has pointed out, has dropped, and, you know, you buy songs on iTunes for 99 cents, I mean, what's left other than the publishing? I mean, what do you think about that?
I think that there could be truth to that, but I think it's a deeper issue than that. I think it's more of just a cultural thing of, you know, there was that kind of mode in the 60s, that thinking where you just don't, you know, artists write their own material. They don't co-write, or they don't go for outside songs. And I think that a lot of artists today, especially in the last like 6-7 years, you see that kind of same consciousness where they want to create it, they want to write it themselves, and they want to play it themselves. I'm talking especially in rock music. I think you have more of a willingness for people to collaborate perhaps in other formats of music than in rock. But the kinds of things I see in terms of the acts that are signed today, you know, different kinds of bands that are out there. It's pretty much self-contained, and A&R people look for that. They don't necessarily look for, you know, collaborating with somebody or giving a band, a rock band, an outside song.
But don't you think collaboration, though, in the 80s got out of hand, like with David Foster, where, you know, we'd come in, find a band that sounded decent enough, replace all the players on the band, have Toto write the music, and then all of a sudden, you know, you got Chicago and the Tubes, and it's pretty much the same bands with the lead singer of those bands churning out tunes that they didn't write.
But the music was a lot better then, I've got to say.
But that brings up the whole topic.
Good point, though.
You know, when I sent the email out to you guys about, you know, what the podcast was going to be about, you know, I labeled it Why Music Sucks, you know? But also, does it really suck though today? I mean, and part of that whole thing, what I mean by that is because you look at, you know, like Bobby said, everybody looks at the 80s and like, oh, look at all that great music. And you get a lot of guys like the Thompson Twins with their songs. I mean, their songs were, you know, they had great, great songs. But I find that today you have artists that are doing just as innovative things, you know, as they were doing back then. And, you know, we all say music sucks today, but I think it's specific genres. And I think like radio has a lot of sucky music on it, but you look at a lot of independent labels and things like that. There's some great music coming on.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting point you're making, because what I think people mean is that music sucks as far as top 40. Music sucks as far as the commercial radio goes, or the Hot 100 albums, you know. But when you start searching for things in other areas, like what you and I were talking about before, of electronica or world music or some of the more eclectic independent stuff out there, there's some very, very innovative things. You're just not necessarily hearing it on top 40. But that's the interesting thing about the world we live in today. It's like, you know, it was the best of times, the worst of times, but the great stuff, I think, you have to search much harder for than you did in the past.
Well, there's a lot more music these days. I mean, that's compared to the 80s, yeah. We're just swamped with music everywhere.
I mean, I think what's great is, like, I just picked up XM Radio, and I know we've discussed the quality of it, but what's interesting is they've got their top 40 stations, but then you can start finding these alternative stations, and I'm like, wow. And, you know, living in L.A., you would think that this would be, like, the music capital, but a lot of times when I went to Seattle and other cities, I thought the radio stations played a much more interesting set of music than L.A. ever did, because it was always the top 40, the pop, the stuff you're like, yeah, yeah. I kept feeling I got spoon-fed all of the music, and it was just like, enough of this already. Let me hear something interesting. Let me hear something with soul, where somebody's actually saying something rather than just a beat and a catchy melody. But I'm
catchy melody, there you go.
Well, sometimes, you know.
Well, I heard an interview with Brian Eno that was on the BBC, I think last week, where it was mainly about his 7 million paintings exhibit, but he started talking about just working in music and about when he started. If you had a conversation with anybody about music, everybody had heard every important record that had come out then. Everybody had heard Hendrix. Everyone heard Janis Joplin. Everyone heard Zeppelin. Now, the conversation always starts with, have you heard this? No. Oh, have you heard this? No. Well, it's like this, and it's from this place. And there's no sort of, I don't know, collective consciousness of the music that's out there.
Yeah. Well, part of it is because anybody can now put out a record from their living room. You know, a laptop computer.
Go to NAM and,
I think this brings up a really good point, what you say, Rob, though. You know, if you go back.
It usually does.
You go back.
He's back.
Thank you, Rob. It's good to be here.
Your head looks much bigger today. But, you know, there was a time when you would, when we talk about bands, you know, you would, and we're talking about Eno around that time, you'd have bands that grew up together, that recorded long albums together, that toured together, like Genesis. You'd find things like Selling England by the Pound or Nursery Crime were like 15-minute songs. Mm-hmm. And that's the only thing, because of technology, to me, bringing that back in, is that everything's so fast and so quick and so edited, and everybody can do everything so quickly and at home. They don't need a band. They don't need to think that anything's going to go past 4 or 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so you're losing a little bit of, like, the great novel, the great deepness of something. It's becoming very much the front line, but not the deep line. You know, we're getting a quick happiness. We're getting it straight away, and we can move on because of technology. We can hear it on our iPod. We can hear it on our phone. We can see it on the TV. It's very fast. In the era we're talking about, some of the, and I truly believe it's not because of our age that we're saying this. I truly believe that some of the artistry is suffering for that because we don't want to see a band grow up together for a long period of time and to be given that chance by an A&R department or a record company to develop something very unique.
You know what I think?
Like Led Zeppelin, you know, or you too.
A lot of people would agree with that. And the sad part of it all is even you'd find a lot of young people who'd agree with that.
Yes. Yeah.
But it just it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Just like, you know, everybody agrees the sound quality of an MP3, you know, just isn't as good as a CD, which isn't as good as something better than a CD, which there are lots of options for. But it just doesn't matter. People are willing to listen to MP3s. And the same thing. A lot of people say, well, you know, that latest Britney Spears song, I know it's not great art or anything, but I like it and it's fun to dance to and it sounds great. So.
Unless something changes in the culture, like Richard was mentioning, that some we get tired of something or something comes along that really does suddenly change our view of something.
Which will happen.
Because it's always, we can get tired
of
something.
But do you think that's always cycles? Many times great music came out of anger or out of somebody, just frustration, mm-hmm. where if you look at the whole 60s and you talked about a lot of stuff and or and I think that right now, I don't know if people are angry enough. I don't know if they really want to say anything. It's also, it seems like a lot of pop music is more about looking good, dancing good, mm-hmm. getting a good rhythm, and it's more about looks. I mean, yeah, they can sing enough, fine, we get a good band behind them, but it's the show. It's the
well, I mean,
pop music's been like that forever.
But that's yeah. No, but I mean, look at the Thompson Twins. They were, you know, it was all about the looks.
Well, the Beatles were that as well at the beginning. Well, how they looked.
Yeah, I used to, it's interesting because I feel like, you know, when we talk about these kinds of acts, and Martin made a great point when he talked about the lack of depth that we will invest in an act. We won't go that far because we're not even given that chance anymore. You know, when you look at like a U2 is probably the greatest example of the last act of, I think it's kind. I don't see anyone coming up in that vein because of the fact that, you know, nothing is developed anymore. Acts have to, that was the point I started out with, is that artists have to develop themselves today. There's no system anymore to develop talent. It's sort of, you develop yourself, and if you're lucky enough, you're grabbed by the label, and, you know, like, Dave Matthews is a classic example of this. This is a guy who started at 21, and he toured and made two or three records in a 6.5 or 7 year period, and he was like 29 or 30 years old by the time he was signed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's like, 42 now, and he's been making records for 12 years. But, you know, he's somebody who came up with 35,000 on his first record, or 25,000 on his first record. He toured, he built a base, 35,000 on the second record. RCA got him, and they built a good, solid career with him. Interesting thing about Matthews, though, is that here's an artist who does far more phenomenal business live than he ever does on record. You know, much like the Grateful Dead or Fish or any of these acts. I mean, he is usually the number one, two, or three selling, you know, live act, except maybe when the Stones tour, every year. I mean, he does phenomenal business. I mean, business that's like staggering mm-hmm. in terms of people that will pay, you know, good money, 40, 50, 60 bucks to go out and see him live. This is where I think the future of artistry lies for bands that want to have careers. I think the interesting thing is that I think you're going to have many, 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 many more types of music having success, but smaller success. I think the era of the 10-12 million mega seller are over. And I think the reason for that is that we live in a culture that just has way, way too much choice. Mm-hmm. You know? Yes. So therefore, and the systems that allowed the Def Leppard Pyromania to sell 12 million or right. Britney Spears to sell 50, they're gone. Those systems are gone. They're gone from retail. They're, as you said, they're gone from radio where nobody has interest to listen to. Anybody who loves music seriously does not listen to terrestrial radio anymore at all. You know, the valuations of radio stations in this country have plummeted 18% in the last 24 months in the stock market. Mm. I mean, that's an interesting thing right there, meaning their ad revenues, everything's down. So people have sort of abandoned that. I mean, you know, not in disastrously so, but I think more and more people have turned away from radio as a means of being exposed to music.
You know, at the NAMM show, I went to the Sennheiser party, and they had the group OK Go play at the House of Blues. And did you guys, any of you guys, make it there to the Sennheiser? Anyhow, the thing about OK Go is when they first started playing, I was like, okay, this is another one of those bands, and they really didn't grab me. And then all of a sudden, they started doing some really interesting things with their video screen behind them, and then with their music, and then they did an ELO cover tune, and then it was just like, you know, I really got into it. But the thing that was really amazing about the whole, just the whole experience is I really felt like it was a shift of how you're going to enjoy live music, because their video was so integrated into their whole act with their screen and with the cameras on their stands. And it's not like, you know, other people have done the similar things before, but just the way they promote themselves and just the way they've started doing, you know, if you go on YouTube and you see some of their music videos that have been released on YouTube.
The videos broke that band completely. Exactly. And a lot of people, even a lot of people who love the band say, oh, the music's okay, but the videos are amazing.
Yeah, and their videos are really, really good. And I just felt like, you know, this is, you're going to see a lot more of this. You're going to see a lot more of this internet phenomenon. And this is how you translate it. And these guys, I think they're going to have a pretty decent career if they keep along those paths with all the innovation. My question to you, Rich, is what kind of advice would you give people out there who are listening to this podcast, you know, and they're starting a band and they want to go, it's all about self-promotion now. Give me some advice. And this is really open up to anybody as to, you know, what would you say, what kind of steps should they take? Where should they go? How do they do this? Do they still look for an A&R person, or do they start doing it on their own, or they YouTube it? What would you suggest?
My suggestion for any artist beginning today who wants a career in music is to build a base from a live perspective. That's where I think the future of any kind of act lies. If you can build a base of people who want to come see you live, I believe you will have a career whether you have hit records or not. And I believe that it's that kind of base that you know, OK Go is a good example, who used, you know, the live performance, translating it into the videos, and built their whole base before they became, you know, a signed act. I think any act today, the idea of, you know, hoping that a record company will discover you, or hoping that a record company will give you a chance, especially on a major label, and give you the kind of push and promotional dollars, I think those days are over, and I think they have been over for over a decade. I think any artist today who wants to start a career, you know, as talented as they may be, I think needs to do it from a live base. I think there's a couple things that are gained from that. Number one, it really teaches you the value of connecting with an audience. Number two, it really helps you if you have product. I think that, you know, you should be selling a CD, you know, at your shows, or at best, you know, giving away maybe a sampler, you know, building a base through, you know, email addresses, anything you can do to make the live experience, and garner people from that perspective. I think the idea of, you know, trying to get a record deal just on the basis of your talent, look, if you want to still do that, great, go ahead and try it. I think there's so few opportunities, though, for those kinds of acts today. Now, that's in the rock field. If you're in the pop field or in the R&B field, if you can come with a hit song, I think you will always have an opportunity to be signed. I mean, if you can go to any major label, a Warner Brothers, a Columbia, an Interscope, and you have what they feel are hit songs. Right. These are songs that we feel we can get on the radio, and this would be a hit. You can get a deal.
Now, what does it mean in today's music economy to be signed? What does that simply mean?
It means that you're under contract to a record label for any period of time, meaning
a slave.
for one record.
Right.
Or it could be even, you know, I hear a lot of deals today are licensing deals where the record is already made and they simply license the music for a period of time. I think the days of record companies, you know, the smart managers, and there are a few of them out there, no longer sign acts for 7 albums, you know, right, to a record label. And I think, you know, part of the reason that they don't do it, you know, it's interesting. There's a dichotomy in that. Record companies are always, you know, talking out of one side of their mouth about, you know, artist development and, you know, we want, you know, young acts that we can develop. And yet, you know, what is the percentage of acts that they sign that they don't make a second record with because they didn't meet some sort of sales criteria or whatever and they let them go? There's no commitment to develop anything. So, you know, that my whole point is that, you know, if you have an act, and this goes back to my point that I was making before, if you have an act that has a strong live base and has sold even 20 or 30,000 units, you can get a much better deal at a record label on your own terms than you can if you were just to be signed
Kind of like with Springsteen in New Jersey. I mean, it was like he had such a huge following. And when
he
was in Boston,
yeah.
They kept saying, Springsteen who? And they go, you got to check this guy's concert out. And they're huge fans.
I'm going to just jump back for a second to, you know, what it's like to be signed and get a record deal. And there are a few misconceptions that most of the public has about the value in getting a record deal. You hear any young band playing and they all say, oh, we're going to get signed. We're going to get a record deal. And we haven't talked about it that much on the podcast, but I spent the last, close to 5 years, over 4 years, developing an artist from when he was a kid all the way up to when he got a major deal. And so I've lived this process and all of the good and bad parts of it. And I think the biggest mistake that bands and individual artists make is that they assume that the record company is going to be doing things that they should be doing for themselves. I mean, let's face it, A&R people, nowadays, they don't really do A or R very well. It used to be artist and repertory or repertoire, whatever.
Right.
So, you know, it's finding the artist and then finding the songs for the artist. And nowadays, I'm sorry, but most of them that I've encountered, and it's been more in the R&B world, but you've got...
A-R-S-E.
You've got a lot of people with just stacks of CDs sitting in their office. They don't return calls. They don't want to make a wrong decision because as soon as they do, they know they're expendable and they're going to be fired. You have a lot of people judging artistry who couldn't create any art on their own if their life depended on it. And you've got talented, creative people being judged by idiots. And that's not...
How do you really feel about that?
It's not the rule everywhere, but I've found it to be more the rule than the exception these days. And it didn't used to be that way. But labels don't do artist development the way they used to. And basically, the artist needs to do everything that they think the record company is going to do for them. They need to try to do it first for themselves as well as possible. Don't think that a label is going to come up with your image. Don't think that they're necessarily going to find your hit song because they're not going to hire you unless they hear something from you that they think is marketable. And times have really changed. It's not a bad thing if you can get a major label deal and have the label behind you and have them spend millions of dollars to get you out there and not, you know, and not have a lousy deal that you end up paying them back, you know, four generations later. If you can get all that happening, a major label deal can launch your career like nothing else can. But number one, nowadays, it's not necessary to get your music out there to have a deal like that. And having a deal like that more often than not gets you tied up so that you're not in control of your own career anymore. And there's nothing even saying that after you get this miraculous record deal you've been hoping for all these years, there's not even a guarantee that they're going to put out your product. I mean, so many acts, as soon as there's any chink in the armor about, you know, they may not be successful for any reason. It could be the way you dance. It could be, oh, we tried you in this blue outfit and you look terrible in blue. So, you know, now this one company isn't going to hire you for their clothing ads. So the label's not behind you anymore because you're not going to be doing Gap commercials because you look terrible in jeans. Things like that can come out. And guess what? You look bad in jeans. So these 10 incredible songs you were about to put out on an album now get shelved. And your career is just not your own anymore. So before you go after a major label deal, figure out, number one, whether that's really the right thing for you. Figure out if there's anything you're counting on the label to do for you that you should be doing for yourself. And go into it with your eyes open because most young acts don't.
Well, this is a good point because I'll bring in Bobby here because Bobby is working with a young artist now and you're putting together some tracks, which is really the beginning of a situation, isn't it, Bobby?
Yep, absolutely.
And it can be a great thing to do. I don't regret any of what I went through because a lot of great music came from it, and it's a very rewarding experience. The trick is to have realistic expectations.
But, you know, I don't mind, though, that the record companies got their asses kicked, to be honest, just for the fact that what's happening now, and it's happening in entertainment, movies and records, somebody woke up and said, we can make a lot of money from this industry. And then they want to be able to make that consistent. They, you know, in business, you want guarantees. How much can we make 20% more next year and 20% more and 20? They want to grow. And the entertainment industry is a very fickle, strange things based on what the audiences want. And what I like, you talked about the jeans and all that. Now, I think we got to go back to the music. We talked about, you know, the bands of Genesis and Floyd and Joplin. It's about the music. It wasn't about everything else. And we've tied so much weight to these artists and so many different things that they've got to become. You know, they just want to play. Listen to the music, enjoy the music, and anything else that comes out of that is secondary. But sometimes the gene sets are more important.
I think the problem with that, though, is that the music does not generate money at this point. Because first of all, maybe you can get 99 cents a song if you're lucky because everybody downloads it. But as soon as it's been downloaded once, it's out there. And you definitely do lose some sales for that. And I think it's the other revenue streams that's what make an artist be able to make money. It's the live shows. It's the merchandise. It's doing ad tie-ins or anything else they can do is how an artist can sustain their career until they get to a point
but the question
where they're selling
is
a certain number of records. But I think an interesting thing about the labels now is it seems as though the only functions left that they can serve possibly better than you is promotion and distribution. Those are the two parts where a label has a network going that you may not be able to tap into on your own.
No, and that can be a great
thing. But even with that, as soon as you have a presence as an artist, and it doesn't have to be a huge presence, but an example of a band that has a huge presence is Radiohead, and they're unsigned, and they couldn't care less.
They want to be unsigned.
And they're making their record, and they will sign basically a licensing deal. They will maybe have a distribution deal with a label, and it will not be a major. Yeah. And I'm sure of it, because their revenue, they'll make a lot of money from their records, but they're making it from everything.
But if you look at the great bands we were talking about, the bands that have lasted decades, it's about their music. And sure, if they do car commercials and do all these great things, I think that's fine. But you always remember them for their music.
Because you got to know them from their music first. I mean, you know, now, and Pete Townsend's taken a lot of heat, you know, for this thing that you're talking about of, you know, licensing for every TV show and for commercials and, you know, and he defends it. But we got to know all of the Who material over the years because of the music. But it's an interesting thing, and I don't blame the labels exclusively for it. I think that there's a deeper issue to address your thing that you brought up, which is that a lot of artists themselves and a lot of managers push this whole notion of, you know, now that you've got the record, now we're going to put you on the TV show, and we've got to get you into the movie, and we've got to get you into the commercial, and we've got to get you into this, hair care products. I mean, you know, Beyonce, when she broke, was a classic example of this oversaturation, where everywhere you turned, every magazine cover, you couldn't escape her in the 7-Elevens at 2 a.m. She was staring back at you from a box of hair coloring products. It's this overwhelming thing of the artist in every aspect of culture that just simply burns themselves out. Yeah. I mean, I can name you 10-12 people that have done this. They sold a million albums and then they burned themselves out. Mm-hmm. Or even successful, even artists like Springsteen, who I remember on his, not this past album, but the last album he did. I mean, just was this intense push to do every talk show, every morning, you know, Good Morning America, open the Grammys, you know, because there's this feeling.
Is that the artist, do you think, or do you think it's the company promoting
the
artist?
It's both, because they don't feel that there's any outlet for them, and that's why they do it. They don't feel that radio, AOR radio, it like doesn't, these heritage artists, there's no place for them at all for a new Springsteen record to get exposed. There's no place for a new Aerosmith record to get exposed. So you'll find Aerosmith doing the Super Bowl. You'll find them doing these, you know, different kinds of ads or whatever to get that exposure, because they don't feel that there's any other outlet for them. Now, that's one thing when a Springsteen or Aerosmith, but I'm talking about a lot of these, you know, new acts that just sort of come out, they have some success, and then it's sort of like the attitude is, we better go for it now because you won't have a career in a year. And I think it's so damaging. I really do. It's a consciousness that I just think is so damaging to the long-term ability to actually, from your perspective of loving music, actually having interest in that band for the second or third record.
I think when the Chili Peppers record came out, it actually hit us that was something that we could believe in.
Yeah.
You heard it on the radio and you went like, oh, am I listening to something real here? And you heard the Hendrix things and you thought, ah, this is real. And I think that there's a mass gravitation to something that we could believe in, and it came at the right time. You know? And that's why they got such a...
But take the Chili Peppers record, because now you drive on the freeway in Los Angeles and you see...
Yeah.
No, you see the big advertisements.
Disneyland.
Yeah. Disneyland, yeah. Space Mountain. Mountain rocking to the Chili Peppers, you know? And it's just like, and I think one of the things is about, it's a cultural phenomenon. Mm. I think we're just, you know, it's our culture. I mean, record companies aren't just record companies. I mean, they are multinational conglomerations that have all kinds of businesses, and they're going to, you know, look for every avenue, every office in their building, whatever that person does, what can you do with this product? You know?
But it becomes like a toy. It's a product of the day where you go, I got an artist. We'll sell it. It'll be this year's hype. It'll be great. We'll hit them. We'll make a ton of money. And then all of a sudden, we'll get the next artist because there's so many people that want to partake in this business.
But is it radio that Rich was bringing up? Do you think radio is really a cause of this, a great thing?
I don't think it's necessarily a cause. I think radio has become so timid and so unwilling to expose music the way that they once did. I think people have turned away from it in droves. I think it's why an XM and a Sirius satellite radio have 4-6 million, you know, people willing to pay $9.95 a month and what is it, $300 for the unit or $200 for the unit or whatever it is, because they want a viable alternative. You know, XM and Sirius radio each have, I think, 125 radio stations that you can listen to, you know, any number of types of music.
But even the drive-ins now are all shock jock.
Sorry?
I mean, it got to the point where I'm driving in because I have an hour commute. I don't want to hear every station shock jock. Right. There's no music. Mm-hmm. You can't find it.
So these radio stations that, you know, XM and
right,
the playlists are very different.
Very, very wide and diverse. Yeah. And I think also, you know, just not only looking at satellite radio, Martin, but looking at podcasts, iPods, you know, kids. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, if another kid had 20 to 40 records, that was a healthy collection. You see these kids today, 15, 16, with their iPods that have 5,000 and 7,000 songs on them. I mean, literally, that's what? That's like, you know, 1,000 CDs or something, or 900 CDs? It's like, it's astonishing, the volume.
They purchased every one.
Yeah.
And there's not one chorus in any of them.
Well, but you see, you know, that brings up another interesting point, which is, you know, that I think one of the, you know, you brought up the point that, you know, record companies are suffering, and I think one of the major reasons that they're suffering today is because of their myopic stance on embracing the times that they were in.
Sure.
They truly didn't get the times that they were in, and Napster was a wonderful opportunity, you know, in 1998, 1999, to see where the culture was going. And instead of embracing that and finding a way to monetize that P2P,
right,
they fought it. They thought they could control it. They thought they could, you know, litigate their way out of it and force you through lawsuits or whatever it is to, and it's almost like, in a sad sense, the world has moved on.
I just want to jump in. I know we're running out of time, but I have one question for Rich that I'm dying to hear the answer to, and I want to ask it just before we run out of time.
Okay, go ahead.
I want to know what made you decide to leave an A&R position, and was it one specific thing, or
he signed Martin? Ruination of his career and life.
So wasn't his choice.
My first time seeing him tonight after 20 years. No, I think it was a combination of many things. I think
when did you leave?
I left Arista in 87, and I didn't want to make A&R my career. I didn't want to make making records and doing that kind of work my career. I had done it for 7 years, and it was enough. I felt I had a calling to do other things, and I taught. I taught courses in the music business for many years after that. I taught at UCLA, and I taught at Trebus Institute of Recording Arts, which was a recording school. I didn't teach any recording. I taught about the music business. But that was the main reason. It wasn't something that I wanted to pursue after that. It's almost like I had gotten burnt out. I had done it enough. And it didn't hold the appeal to me, at that point after doing it for 7 years. So I moved on.
And thank goodness that you did, because we wouldn't have all these great directories.
No.
Hey, how was that? Was that good?
That was good.
Well, hey, listen, Rich, we could sit here and talk all night.
I think
thank
we've
you.
Proven that.
Thank you so much. If there's one thing that I just want to kind of wrap everything up with, is as much as we've talked a lot about the doom and gloom and everything, it seems to me that from evidence at the NAMM show and the fact that the music industry is healthy – and
very
technology. And actually, if you're a young band or if you're a young artist, it gives you a lot of hope, because there are so many different avenues to to make it, to take it to whatever kind of success that you want to get, that that it just seems like there's a lot of hope.
I totally agree, and I think it's a wonderful time for that. I think you have to be open to the kinds of opportunities that are out there, but I think you have to be willing to really work hard at it. And I think, you know, part of the doom and gloom is if you're expecting a system that once existed in the past, then you will be disappointed. If you're expecting, like Rob said, you know, a record company to be doing it for you, a record company to be giving you your manager and your image and your song and the song. No, you have to have that vision for yourself and you have to have that ability for yourself. But I agree with you. I think there's so many more opportunities technologically and culturally for artists to be exposed. And I think the greatest thing for the future for music is that it's going to be all about niches. Many, many more artists selling fewer records rather than five companies selling everything.
Well, yeah. And they're going to get more money for what the records they sell. So that'd be,
that's yeah. right. Yeah, that's right.
10 on 90 is no more an option.
Right.
Well, Rich, we're going to have you back because okay. this has just been great. And thank
I
you
think
very
Rich
much.
Gets applause. What do you think? Yay!
That was
some really good.
Lively discussions. And before we go, I just want to take care of a couple of little things of business. Number one, Rob, what's our update on the DMP7? We're on the DMP7 shipping watch.
Big news there, Mike.
That was very Hollywood. I don't believe you.
All righty. Well, we'll be getting,
It's coming soon. They're still completely disassembled on my table waiting for rubber bands to make the faders move.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. Well, we're waiting for the DMP7s because I'm not going to give away another one until, you know, we're up and running.
Well, I'm fixing all three of them because I don't want to have to go through this three times. So they're all split apart.
Okay. Well, we have a Roland D2 drum machine that I'm going to be giving away. So all you have to do to get the Roland D2 drum machine is send an email to audio@nowcastnetwork.com and tell us why you like the Audio Nowcast.
You don't even know yet, many.
That's it. That's all you have to do.
Just also, everybody, watch the Grammys, because if I do get to go up on stage, I will have an Audio Nowcast sign. Well, not really.
But what about our engineer tonight?
Yeah. You have to talk about our guest engineer.
Yes.
Our guest engineer is also our producer, April Mastropaolo. But
I just wanted to make an announcement of something that's coming up.
Absolutely.
Okay. I actually was going to say it last week, but I forgot. I'm creating an organization in the gaming world called the IESD. It is going to be launched in March at the Computer Game Developers Conference in San Francisco in March. The IESD stands for Interactive Entertainment Sound Developers. It's basically we're taking some of the stuff from AES, some stuff from the Film Academy, and we're building an organization of professionals in the gaming world. You have to have worked on at least one game in a year in the industry before you can join. And we're going to be talking about standards and practices and kind of leading the audio industry in the gaming world. And, you know, it's kind of what film was, you know, 50, 60 years ago. Gaming starting and, you know, asking everybody if they want to join. It's going to be part of the GANG, which is the Game Audio Network Guild. Different than the Audio Now. No. Anyway, I recommend everybody join. It's about $100. And we're going to be the people that are going to start creating the future of audio for games.
So, oh, that's great. Is there a website that you can
It's going to be over at thegang.org, okay. GameAudioNetwork.org. It's going to be a little bit different than GANG. We're going to be a branch of it, but it's going to be a little bit higher level, a more master class. We're going to be looking at the issues that are going to be happening in the in that industry, and it's kind of exciting because not only is it dealing with, you know, computer games, but it's dealing with interaction. You can now download movies on your Xbox. You can now do casual games on telephones. We're addressing all of it. There's really not been a great group that's been addressing the new generation of media, and we're hoping to create that. I've done it also, real quick, The Four Horsemen. I've got Scott Selfman from Microsoft, Dave Morant from Sony, Gene Simmel from High Moon. We're the Four Horsemen. We're putting this thing together, and the response we're getting is incredibly overwhelming.
Well, that's great. And, you know, that's going to be, for a lot of people that listen to the podcast that are in schools,
that's going to be where the jobs are. So I think that's a pretty cool thing, and we'll have to check that out. Well, I just want to remind everybody, if you have any questions for any of the panel members, or if you want to come on down and just kind of watch how this whole thing goes down, you can send us an email at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And that's it, guys. And it was great to have Rob back.
Good to be back. I was here last time, right?
Yeah.
Physically?
Sort of.
Okay.
And Andrew, and when are the Grammys?
The 11th, February 11th.
The 11th, so yeah. That's before the next podcast. So great. Have you got your tuxedo and everything?
Yeah, I do. It was a saga, but we won't go into it. But yes, I have a tux.
So if you want to know what Andrew looks like, watch the Grammys.
Yeah, we hope.
Yeah, we hope.
He's going to be the one.
So we should do the podcast while watching the Grammys.
Oh, and
oh, look, there's Andrew right there. Yeah.
No, he's going to be the one with the T-shirt that has the tuxedo on it and the shorts. So
gave it away.
Flip-flops.
Gave it away.
All righty. And Martin, how's everything going with all your ventures and your CD?
Everything's going good, Mike. I hope to be at it, release the record at the end of February. And
wow.
Done all the photo shoots and everything's ready to go. So I'm very excited.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's really appropriate for what we were talking about. You know?
It is, actually. Rich has been very helpful in helping me progress as well. So and I learned a lot tonight. So I should put that into operation, hopefully.
That's great. All right. Well,
and Bobby, we don't care what you're up to.
Bobby's developing an act, actually. We're talking about. Yeah.
Skipped right over.
A comedy act. He's doing a comedy show.
Sorry, we just skipped right over.
Yeah, he's on more.
And Bobby,
the great focus of the world.
Actually, Paige, you keep saying about the act. The act, actually, Martin introduced me to is a talented young lady. Her name's Kyra, and she got an award in December, right, for
yes,
the best new top 40 artist. And want to do a couple tracks with her, doing good old pop songs.
Yeah,
well, that's great.
Pop dance songs. Yep, should be good in a couple of years' time.
All right. Well, from all the guys here, thank you for listening to Audio Nowcast, and we'll see you later.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbitier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaolo and uses Apex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.